Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You are listening to the Heritage Radio Network. The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information on Cane Vineyard and Winery, visit www.cane5.com.
A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palacio, your host here on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm happy you tuned in today. We're going to be talking about curry today. Curry is, it's sort of like a catch-all. It's one of the most widely used and probably misused, according to many people, terms in the culinary world. And in fact, outside of India, the word curry is often a catch-all to describe Indian dishes or Indian food in general that Indians rarely use to describe their own cuisine. So what is curry? Well, we are going to turn to Colleen Taylor-Sen, who is a food historian and journalist specializing in the cuisine of India. She's the author of Food and Culture in India and a regular contributor to publications such as Travel and Leisure, Food Arts, Chicago Sun-Times, the Chicago Tribune, and the Globe, and a recently published a book for the Reaction series called The Edible Series, and those are all the global history series that many of you are familiar with, and her book is called Curry, A Global History. Colleen, welcome.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me on your show.
So I've posed the question, what is curry? I guess we'd start by a definition, a real definition.
Well, I had a lot of trouble when I started doing this book because it is, as you said, it is such a catch-all. And I finally came up with kind of three definitions. It's a meat, vegetable, or fish stew flavored with Indian spices. And I later added Indian to separate it from Mexican dishes, which also look like curries but have different spicing. It's a term used for pretty much any Indian dish with a gravy. And this is something that, as you said, Indians rarely used it, but I've found now that Indians are increasingly using the word curry, I think simply because it's a short form and people everywhere know what it means. But it has to be a dish with a gravy. It can't be like a kebab or a dry dish that doesn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, I define, in my book, I use it to include any dish made with curry powder.
Interesting. Now, so really, curry, and in the etymology of the word curry, there are references made to kari, K-A-R-I, and then some people think, oh, well, it's the curry leaf, or the French word cuir, to cook, because in the 14th century in England, we find it used in form of curry. But really, the curry that we use today has no relation to any of these.
Well, it seems there is a lot of discussion about this, and it seems that it's probably related to a Tamil word, kari, which meant kind of a thin gravy poured over rice.
Uh-huh.
And for some reason, the British picked up on this word, and gradually it came to apply to pretty much any Indian dish with a gravy.
So what we know of the curry leaf, that where does that fall in the whole?
Well, that's a good question
definition.
Because the curry leaf some curry, to look at what curry powder is, curry powder, I kind of did a study of analysis of curry powders, and all curry powders, no matter where they're made or where they're from, have turmeric in them, and most of them have things like coriander seed, cumin seed, mustard seed, fenugreek, black pepper, etc. Mm-hmm. And some of them have curry leaves. Now, curry leaves are a leaf that virtually grows wild in India. I mean, you can find it on the streets, and they use it in South Indian cuisine, and I'm sure your listeners who go to South Indian restaurants will be very familiar with this. And so some curry powders, especially those called Madras curry powders, will have ground up curry leaves in them, but this is really only a minority. A curry powder need not necessarily have curry leaves.
Interesting. Yeah. So it really is a mixture of many different spices, and of course, there are references to these types of spice mixes back into ancient history. But when did we come to know them as curry, and how?
I think the very first commercial curry powder was 1739, and it was produced in Britain. And this is when, the British who had served in India, the early people, came back to India, and they made their piles. Some of them were called the nabobs. They were very, very rich, and they wanted to have the same food that they had back in India, except that, it was hard to find the spices. So some enterprising company got the idea of making a commercial curry powder, and one thing that's interesting is one of the things they really touted about these curry powders were their health benefits and how they really improved your health and had all. And now we're finding today that this is in fact true, that the ingredients in curry powders, especially turmeric have many health benefits to us.
Yeah, turmeric has definitely been touted as a health tonic, if you will, when mixed. But it's interesting because there is a discussion about and I think you mentioned in your book as well, the Indian Asian diaspora really being the reason for so much of the widespread use of curries or sauced meats with spice blends. Was it so much that, or was it the British invasion, the British Empire, the East Indian trading company?
It's actually both. I think in England, England really, curry is virtually the national dish there. I mean, just as in the U.S., if we're going to do takeout, we do Thai or Chinese, or here in Chicago, we do a lot of Mexican, if you want to go out for a quick meal. In Britain, really, the default meal now is curry. It's just sold everywhere. It's sold in pubs, it's sold in supermarkets, and I think that's a combination of things. I think it's, the Brits have historic ties to Indian food has never really caught on in the U.S. the way it has elsewhere, and I think there's many reasons for this, but I think, the British have historic ties with India. It's very much a part of the national psyche when they were an empire, and India was the jewel in their crown. And then you had, of course, after Indian independence and in the 50s and 60s, you had a great wave of immigration from the subcontinent to England who opened restaurants. And, restaurants are an easy way for a new immigrant to get established. So I think that's one reason, many reasons why it's so popular in the UK.
Yeah, it's interesting because the British obviously formed the East India Trading Company, in India, but wasn't that more for the black pepper trade?
Yes, it was. Actually, that was the first great multinational corporation. That's what I like to call it. It had branches all over the world. And, in the U.S., don't forget, the people who shipped the tea to Boston Harbor, that was the East India Company.
Oh, that's right.
And, they had outposts in Malaysia and throughout the world. And it did indeed start with the pepper trade, except that the pepper trade really goes back to classical times. India was a great exporter of pepper to the Roman Empire, and one reason for its collapse is supposed to be the great outpouring of gold that went to India for spices, and so this has been something that's gone on for thousands of years.
Well, because so many people think, they shy away, people who aren't comfortable with spicy foods shy away from curries, thinking they're all going to be spicy, but there, years way back when these sauces first were developed, there were no chili peppers because that was a new world food. So they're not all spicy mixtures. They're just, they have spices in them, but not piquant. They're not hot necessarily.
Right. And it's interesting that, we think of Indian food as inseparable from chili pepper, but as you said, it was really part of what's called the Columbian Exchange, and They weren't introduced really till probably the sometime in the 17th century. But they did replace something that not only black pepper, but there's something called long pepper that was used in India. It's kind of a, you can get it sometimes in, it's really an Ayurvedic thing, but it's like a little bit like Sichuan pepper, and that was really what chilies replaced to a large degree, was this long pepper that had been used in Indian cuisine.
And that has a very nice, a more subtle flavor, but a nice flavor. You can find it in a lot of Malaysian cooking, you can find it in specialty spice stores still.
Oh, okay.
Here in America, Calusians here in New York, I know I can always find it. But that's right. That's a wonderful flavor, and that the chili and the chili peppers replaced it, unfortunately, but fortunately for some, right? So the trade, the spice trade, had a lot to do with popularizing this curry as we know it, right? That's the UK and the Dutch, and the Dutch did a lot to bring about the popularity of this too, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, people don't know much about the Dutch Empire, but it was the second really great empire and they controlled so much. I mean, they were in Ceylon for Sri Lanka for quite a while, and in Indonesia, and then there was a whole, and you find it today in the Netherlands. I mean, the Netherlands, traditional Dutch food is pretty bland, but after Indonesia got its independence in, I think, the late 40s, when that was, a lot of Indonesians and a lot of Dutch people who had served there came back to Holland, and now you find everywhere in the Netherlands, you find like vending machines that serve all kinds of Indonesian Dutch specialties. You have a lot of these little, they're called, I think, tokos, that are little shops that sell Indonesian Dutch food. You have people from the Indonesian colonies like Suriname that came back to the Netherlands. So you really have, it's really done a lot to enliven the cuisine, not just of the Netherlands, but Germany too. Now, that's a very interesting anomaly among curries, because one of the most popular foods in Germany is this curry.
Yes. Tell us a story about that one. I heard a bit about that. Tell
what
us
did
the
you
background.
Hear?
Well, it was from you in your book.
Oh, okay.
So tell me. Yeah. Let's tell our listeners.
Well, it's basically a sausage, and they grill it, and then they serve it with kind of with peppers and onions, and they serve it with this sauce, this tomato sauce, and then curry powder on top. And where it came from, in fact, I didn't put this in my book because I didn't know it at the time, but I think it probably arose during World War, at the end of World War II, when the British servicemen were there, and one of them went to a restaurant and wanted curry, and of course they didn't know what it was, so they got some curry powder and sprinkled it on the sausage, and that became currywurst. At least that's one explanation. And there's a big debate about where it originated, and there's been novels written about it. There's a movie called The Origin of Currywurst, so it's just enormously popular, and one of these strange anomalies that you wouldn't expect. I think one reason for it, it's when a cuisine is basically a bland cuisine, they need something to spice it up, so they adopt these dishes.
Well, and I think most Americans cooking curry will go to the supermarket and buy a generic bottle of curry powder and mix that up with whatever liquids and oils with the meat. But in true curry, this spice mix would be made a la minute, right? I mean, they would make it right before they'd use it.
Well, yes and no. That's a good question. My husband is Indian, and he's a pretty good cook. He does our cooking, and there's some dishes that you would use kind of ready-made curry powder or garam masala. The British style curries, kind of the basic chicken curry. Actually, they probably made better with a curry powder as opposed to mixing your spices, which would be for a more elaborate Indian dish. He grew up. He remembers the British days in Calcutta, which was the capital of British India. Mm-hmm. And the curry powder he likes is the kind you buy in, you buy them in Chinese and Vietnamese store. There's one Vietnamese curry powder that he says very much like the old-style British curry powder he remembers when he was a little kid.
Interesting.
And if we're making, you know, Indian food can be very labor-intensive, very time-consuming.
Right.
I mean, it's not the sort of thing that, you know, you whip up every day. But for quick Indian meals, we'll just use, like, ready-made curry powder and maybe ready-made garam masala. And, you know, it's not as great as the real thing, but at least you don't have to, you know, cook for hours.
That's right. Well, and funny that it's sort of become Indian fast food. And we here in New York, we have a shop even called Curry in a Hurry. It's, you know, all these ready-made curries. You go in and like a steam table or a McDonald's, you know, you quick, all the food is already prepared, and you just point to this and that, and you get your curries. It's great because you get a totally different flavor than the usual, as you say, boring, bland food. So it's kind of a nice thing in a way, I guess, right?
Well, I think there is a global trend towards spicier food. I mean, especially in the United States. I mean, it almost is like a revolution that any restaurant you go to now, I mean, they have Tabasco sauce on the table. I mean, even German restaurants will give it to you now. And I think, you know, our love of Thai food, our love of Mexican food is all part of this. So I think we're all tending towards wanting more. And the one explanation given is that as the population gets older, our taste buds are, you know, not as sensitive as they used to be. So aging palates demand more spices.
They need to be awakened a little more.
Yes.
Right. Well, you know, you mentioned our love of Thai food. Interesting, because we find a lot of Thai curries. Thai curries are found in so many different cultural cuisines. The Chinese, the Thai, the Malaysian. One that surprised me was Japanese.
Oh, Japanese curry is another of these anomalies. I really wrote a lot about it in the book because it's so intriguing. It actually was brought by the British. The British had a settlement, I think it was Yokohama, and at this time, after the Meiji Restoration, the emperor was trying to get people to, especially the army, to eat more meat because, you know, to build up their strength. And one way they thought of doing this was to use, and especially beef, because the Japanese component meant that people were very reluctant to eat beef. And for some reason, curry just, one way of eating this meat was with curry. And they started, you know, stews, and then a company called, oh my goodness, I've forgotten the name. It's the main Japanese purveyor of these ready-made curries now. It's not C&B, but it's like C&B from Cross and Blackwell's.
Mm-hmm.
And they started, and now it's probably the number one comfort food in Japan. And it's something that mothers make for home, school kids have at lunch. It's not something you'd serve guests, but it's just become a very, and they have curry shops, too, in Japanese cities. And they're different from the Indian restaurants that serve regular Indian food. But it's just become enormously popular. And there's a cartoon with curry in it. There's a Japanese wrestler called Curry Man. And he has moves like the spice rack. And it's very interesting cultural phenomenon.
Well, there's reference in the book to a Caribbean curry dish called kari raisu. Is that something?
That's Japanese, yeah. Kari raisu.
Kari raisu is Japanese. Oh, I see. It's not Caribbean. But the Caribbean has its own curries as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Trinidad. I mean, 40% of the population of Trinidad is from India originally. When slavery was abolished in the British Empire, they started bringing in indentured laborers who could go and work for 5 years, and then they would, you know, could go back or get land, and most of them stayed. So Trinidadian food especially is wonderful, and I think in New York you're very fortunate because you have, also Jamaican food. I mean, Jamaican has a lot of interesting, like, goat curry and roti and things,
right.
You have a wonderful, thriving Caribbean food culture in New York City.
Yeah, interesting. And I was actually, I'm quite familiar with Malaysian food, but it was interesting to me that rendang is considered a curry. Well, because it's a gravy, a sauce dish on a meat, right?
Yeah,
so
I
like
kind of included
rendang?
This. Yeah, that was just my definition. And it had kind of Indian, Indonesian-style spices. That was kind of the other component that I used.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. It's probably the most international or internationally recognized food preparation of a dish, even though each one varies so dramatically. I wondered, what do you think is the greatest myth about curry and what curry is? I mean, that it's Indian, I mean, because it's not, I mean, it's not, it is Indian in terms of origin, but now it's taken on so many forms.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any single myth about curry as such. I think that I think there's a lot of misconceptions about Indian food. One is that, as you mentioned, that Indian food is always hot. It really varies a great deal. I mean, I know in my husband's family, the food is really bland, and it's not for me. I mean, for my sake, it's just the way they eat it, and other families. So that varies a lot.
Well, I would like to hear more about the Indian food in particular. We're going to take a short break, and then when we come back, let's explore more about that Indian food explanation.
Great. Okay.
Ooh, that was some good Bollywood music to get us in the mood for some Indian food. We're talking with Colleen Taylor Sen, who has just recently published a book called Curry, A Global History. In fact, Colleen, you're going to be in the New York area. For our New York listeners, Colleen's going to be in New York City on January 31st, the first speaker in a nice little series called Edible Conversations, and you can find out about this on the web at, you can probably search Edible Conversations, and you'll come up with the link to the ticket site. And that's January 31st at the Roger Smith Hotel. I look forward to seeing you and meeting you then, but in the meantime, I'm enjoying talking to Colleen on the phone. And we were just about to describe some of the misconceptions about Indian food, Colleen.
Yes, well, one of them, as I mentioned, is that Indian food is hot. Another is that I just wrote a little book, really for fun, called Pakoras, Paneer, Papadums, A Guide to Indian Restaurant Menus, that's available on Amazon.com.
Oh, and that's going to be really popular. People are really going to want that, I'm sure, because, you know, that menu, sorting out the menus in Indian restaurants can sometimes be a bit daunting.
Well, I think, what stimulated me to write this was a restaurant owner who's a friend of mine, and he complained that all people who go to, most of the people, I shouldn't say all, but 90% of the people who go to his restaurants, and this includes Indians too, order four dishes, and the four dishes are tandoori chicken, butter chicken, samosas, and saag paneer, which is spinach and cheese. And it's absolutely true, since he said that. I look at restaurants when I go, and people are very limited in their choices. And there's so many other, other interesting dishes that they can order. Often I think the restaurant owners aren't too helpful either, or the waiters. They don't want to, push dishes on people. But people maybe should try and branch out a little bit and order something other than those four dishes.
Well, in chicken, well, my husband always orders chicken tikka masala. Would this be considered a curry dish, basically?
Well, yeah, chicken tikka masala is I think it's pretty much the same as butter chicken. I haven't quite been able to figure out exactly the difference, but actually, the way that dish arose, tandoori chicken itself is a very recent thing. People think it's this ancient Indian dish, but actually, it was invented around in the late 1940s by a famous restaurant owner named Kundan Lal Gujral, who actually I had a chance to interview before he died. That was about 30 years ago, and he came from after partition, when India, the subcontinent, was divided between India and Pakistan, he came from North Pakistan near Afghanistan, and they did a lot of cooking in these tandoors, these clay ovens there, and he set up a little roadside stall, and he developed his own marinade for chicken and roasted it, and for various reasons it became very important. Then he eventually opened a restaurant called Moti Mahal, and now it's part of a chain. So he actually created this dish. And the story is that when he had leftover tandoori chicken, he didn't, as a way of using it, he put it in this buttery, creamy, this tomato buttery, creamy sauce, and he sold it as buttered chicken or chicken tikka masala, as it later became. So this was kind of another invention.
Well, it was very successful because it's a very popular dish.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. Right. And it's always served with naan, which are these wonderful breads that are roasted in the tandoor.
Mm, yes. So what I was trying to describe to somebody the different styles of Indian restaurants, from my knowledge, which is very slim, and the different regions of India. Unfortunately, we don't get a lot of regional Indian restaurants in the U.S.
No, you have a lot more in New York than elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was reading my book, I went to, you know, that menu.com, and I was looking at it was amazing wealth of information. And in New York City, you do have some Goan restaurants. You do have several, you know, quite a few, I think, regional restaurants in some of the Indian shopping areas. But that's absolutely true. And what's funny is you never had them in India either. And we just came back from a trip to Delhi where I hadn't been for 5 years, and I was absolutely flabbergasted at the growth of the Indian restaurant community in Delhi. I mean, you have a couple of, my husband's Bengali, and Bengali food is wonderful. And despite the fact that so many restaurants are owned and staffed by Bangladeshis, they never serve Bengali food. Well, now in Delhi, you have these restaurants serving these wonderful Bengali dishes, and you have other regional things. So even in India, you really couldn't sample these things either.
Well, and how you say that the differences between the bland and the very pungent and spicy, which regions represent which types of foods?
Oh, I don't think you can really generalize about it. I mean, South Indian food, well, Madras curry, if you see that on a restaurant menu, it usually means it's a pretty hot curry. It has, like, chilies in it. I think traditionally South Indian food is known to be hotter, and some Pakistani food can be extremely hot.
Mm.
I mean, this is, you know, this is a meat-based, and there's not really that much distinction between Pakistani and North Indian food. I mean, this is kind of an artificial creation, but generally, that's South Indian and can be pretty hot,
mm-hmm.
but not always.
Right. Right. And, of course, then there's a huge vegetarian population, and I see more and more Indian vegetarian restaurants popping up, which is nice.
Yeah, and in New York you have Indian kosher restaurants, too. they're vegetarian restaurants, and, you know, they're kind of, I guess, certified by a rabbi, and that's an interesting thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just, and that just goes to show how the cultures are all... the world has become a small place, and
yes.
Cultures are embracing other foods and dishes into their usual cuisine. But all of these different, would you say? I mean, I don't know. Do all the different various Indian restaurants or Bengali or Pakistani restaurants include a curry or a form of curry?
Yes, they do. I mean, any dish with a gravy you could call a curry. I've noticed that the word is appearing more on restaurant menus too, Indian restaurant menus, because as I said, in the old days people never used it, but now Indians will use it, and you go to a menu and you go to a restaurant and you'll say, well, what's this dish? And the waiter will say, well, it's a curry. And by that you kind of have a general idea that this is a wet dish as opposed to a, you know, a dry dish as opposed to a kebab. So I think the word is becoming really in more and more widespread use today.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you could, for me, describe a couple of different dishes, because you just mentioned wet as opposed to dry, and of course something that comes from the tandoor oven, which you say is more recent, that of course is a dry dish, it's a dry baked meat or bread. But what would another example of a dish be that is, as you mentioned, a dry dish?
A dry dish. Well, dry dishes are kebabs, and there are many, many kinds of kebabs. I mean, dozens, maybe even hundreds. The most common is Sikh kebab, and Sikh kebab is just, well, it has different meanings. And, this is kind of, kebab is another thing you could do a book
on. Talk about different cultures with kebabs, right?
Oh, my goodness, yeah, it's a universal dish, really. I mean, right. It's everywhere from the Balkans to China. They even have kebabs in China, in the Muslim areas. Sikh kebab is kind of a long, like ground meat put on a skewer, kind of sausage shaped, and that's and then another very nice kebab is a shami kebab, and shami kebab is ground meat mixed with ground chickpeas and spices, and then it's made into patties, and it looks like a hamburger, and it's slightly sautéed, and those are delicious. They're very hard to make. That's one of my favorite kebabs. It's a shami kebab.
Hmm, interesting. I'm actually taking notes, so the next time I go to a restaurant, I'll make sure to order some of these. Because I look forward to reading your little handbook on deciphering the menu and how to order, because that, I think, is going to be extremely helpful to me and to a lot of other people.
Thank you.
Outside of, going outside the curry realm. Not that we don't want to eat curry, because curry is absolutely wonderful. In fact, you see, you relegated an entire book to it. Well, the research for this book must have been fun as well. I mean, a bit daunting, but to fun.
Oh, it was. And fortunately, I'd been to a lot of the places I wrote about, it was so interesting to me just to, to find out how widespread the whole, especially the Indian diaspora. I mean, I had no idea. Really, every continent had people who came in the 19th century, even South America, in Guyana, Southeast Asia, Africa, and South Africa. You have a lot of Indian food in South Africa.
Yes, you spoke about an interesting dish in South Africa, a curry dish that is very popular there. Talk about that.
Oh, it was bunny chow. And
bunny chow is
basically a loaf of Western-style bread that's hollowed out, and you put curry into it. And the way this came was during apartheid. There were a lot of Indian restaurants, especially in Durban. And, of course, the black population weren't allowed to enter. So the Indian restaurant owners got the idea of pouring the curry into a loaf of bread and then passing it, like going to the back of the restaurant and selling it that way.
You're making it portable, right? They could just,
yes, it was portable, right.
Oh, interesting. In South Africa, I mean, who would have thought? That is true, as you say. That really is quite remarkable that the Indians have found themselves in every culture, it seems.
And, absolutely.
And of course, from a culinary point of view, we welcome it because I think the food is very interesting. And just the introduction of the different spices that we might never have delved into is remarkable in itself. And I look forward to hearing more about it and to meeting you when you're in New York City on January 31st. Again, Colleen will be at the Edible Conversations series, and she'll be presenting on January 31st at the Roger Smith Hotel. And I'm so happy that you were able to join me on the radio today, because there's so much more to learn about curry, and I think this will be a very informative book for people who want to know more. It's called Curry, A Global History, and Colleen Taylor Sen is the author. Colleen, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. It was very interesting to talk to you.
Good. This is Linda Palacio, and you've been listening to A Taste of the Past. I'd like to thank my executive producer, Jack Inslee, and please join us again next week for another date on A Taste of the Past.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.